Surely they covered her, and all he could see was a mound of tangled tulips bent low over her body, which was kicking to the last. He described all of that to Qatar as though the dream emphasized his point about the dangers of seriousness. He tried to be as lighthearted as possible in the telling, but at the end, Qatar looked him in the eyes and said, "Why didn't you go help her?" "What? Help her? Pull her out from underneath?" "But she liked it. She was having fun. She liked it." "Are you sure?" Qatar was smiling. "Sure, I'm sure. It was my dream. It was your mother, too." "Oh, man, why are you making something out of it that ain't there? You're making the whole thing into something super serious just to prove your point. First, I'm wrong for not living in Alabama. Then I'm wrong for not behaving right in my own dream. Now I'm wrong for dreaming it. You see what I mean? The least little thing is a matter of life and death to you. You're getting to be just like my old man. He thinks if a paper clip is in the wrong drawer, I should apologize. What's happening to everybody? Looks like everybody going in the wrong direction, but you, don't it?" Milkman swallowed. He remembered that long ago evening after he hit his father and how everybody was crammed on one side of the street going in the direction he was coming from. Nobody was going his way. It was as though Qatar had been in that dream too. "Maybe," he said, "but I know where I'm going." "Where?" "Wherever the party is." Qatar smiled. His teeth were as white as the snowflakes that were settling on his jacket. "Merry Christmas," he said, "and Happy New Year." He waved his hand and cut around the corner to his street. He was lost in the snowy shadows of Southside before Milkman could ask him where he was going or tell him to wait. Now he closed the accounts book in Sonny's shop and gave up on the column of numbers. Something was happening to Qatar, had already happened to him. He was constantly chafing Milkman about how he lived, and that conversation was just one more example of how he'd changed. No more could Milkman run up the stairs to his room to drag him off to a party or a bar. And he didn't want to talk about girls or getting high. Sports were about the only things he was still enthusiastic about, and music. Other than that, he was all gloom and golden eyes, and politics. It was that atmosphere of earnestness he provoked that led Milkman to talking about his family more than he would normally do. And that also led him to defend with flippant remarks the kind of life he led. Pussy and honoré parties. Qatar knew that wasn't all he was interested in, didn't he? He knew Milkman had other interests. Such as, he asked himself. Well, he was very good in his father's business, for one thing. Excellent, in fact. But he had to admit right away that real estate was of no real interest to him. If he had to spend the rest of his life thinking about rents and property, he'd lose his mind. But he was going to spend the rest of his life doing just that, wasn't he? That's what his father assumed, and he supposed that was what he had assumed as well. Maybe Qatar was right, partly. His life was pointless, aimless, and it was true that he didn't concern himself an awful lot about other people. There was nothing he wanted bad enough to risk anything for, inconvenience himself for. Still, What right had Guitar to talk? He didn't live in Montgomery either. All he did was work at that automobile factory and sneak off places. Nobody knew where. And hang around Tommy's barber shop. He never kept a woman more than a few months. The time span that he said was average before she began to make permanent arrangement type noises. He ought to get married, Milkman thought. Maybe I should too. Who? There were lots of women around, and he was very much the eligible bachelor to the honoree crowd. Maybe he'd pick one. The redhead. Get a nice house. His father would help him find one. Go into a real partnership with his father. And what? There had to be something better to look forward to. He couldn't get interested in money. No one had ever denied him any, so it had no exotic attraction. Politics, at least barbershop politics and guitars brand, put him to sleep. He was bored. Everybody bored him. The city was boring. The racial problems that consumed Guitar were the most boring of all. He wondered what they would do if they didn't have black and white problems to talk about. Who would they be if they couldn't describe the insults, violence, and oppression that their lives and the television news were made up of? If they didn't have Kennedy or Elijah to quarrel about, they excused themselves for everything. Every job of work undone, every bill unpaid, every illness, every death was the man's fault. And Guitar was becoming just like them, except he made no excuses for himself. Just agreed, it seemed to Milkman, with every grievance he heard. Milkman went into the bathroom, which served also as a pantry, and plugged in the hot plate to make himself some instant coffee. While he was there, he heard a rapid tapping on the window pane. He stepped back into the office and saw Freddy's eyes through the lettering. Milkman unlocked the door. Hey, Freddy, what's up? Looking for a warm spot. They got me running tonight, Christmas coming and all. All I do is run up and down the street. Freddy's janitor duties at the department store were supplemented by his function as a messenger and package deliverer. They give you a new truck yet? Milkman asked him. You crazy? The engine have to fall out on the ground before they give me a decent one. I put some coffee water on. Have a cup? Just what I'm looking for. Saw your lights and thought there's got to be a hot cup of coffee in there. You wouldn't happen to have a little taste to go in it, would you? Just so happens I do. Attaboy. Milkman went into the bathroom, lifted the lid from the toilet tank, and took out the half-pint bottle he kept hidden from Macon, who wouldn't have alcohol on the premises. He brought the bottle into the office, put it on the desk, and went back to make up two cups of coffee. When he re-entered, Freddy was trying to look as though he hadn't already turned the pint up to his mouth. They laced their coffee, and Milkman looked around for his cigarettes. Hard times, boy, Freddy said absently after his first sip. Hard times. Then, as though he noticed something missing, he asked, where's your buddy? You mean Guitar? Yeah, Guitar. Where is he? Haven't seen him in a few days. You know Guitar. He'll disappear on you in a minute. Milkman noticed how white Freddy's hair was. How old are you, Freddy? Who knows? They made dirt in the morning and me that afternoon, he giggled. But I've been around a long time. You born here? No, down south, Jacksonville, Florida. Bad country boy. Bad, bad country. You know they even got an orphanage in Jacksonville where colored babies can go? They have to put them in jail. I tell people that talk about them sit-ins, I was raised in jail, and it don't scare me none. I didn't know you were an orphan. Well, not a regular orphan. I had people and all. But my mama died, and nobody would take me in. It was on account of the way she died that nobody would take me. How'd she die? Ghosts. Ghosts? You don't believe in ghosts? Well, Milkman smiled. I'm willing to, I guess. You better believe, boy. They're here. Here? Milkman didn't glance around the office, but he wanted to. The wind howled outside in the blackness, and Freddy, looking like a gnome, flashed his gold teeth. I don't mean in this room necessarily, although they could be. He cocked his head and listened. No, I mean they in the world. You've seen some? Plenty, plenty. Ghosts kill my mother. I didn't see that, of course, but I seen them since. Tell me about them. No, I ain't. I don't do no talking about ghosts I seen. They don't like that. Well, tell me about the one you didn't see. The one killed your mother. Oh, well, that one. She was walking across the yard with this neighbor friend of hers, and they both looked up and saw a woman coming down the road. They stopped and waited to see who she was. When the woman got near, the neighbor called out howdy, and soon she said the word. The woman turned into a white bull right before their eyes. My mama fell down on the ground in labor pain right then and there. When I was born and they showed me to her, she screamed and passed out. Never did come to. My father died 2 months before I was born, and they couldn't get none of my people and nobody else to take a baby brought here by a white bull. Milkman started laughing. He didn't mean to hurt Freddy's feelings, but he couldn't stop the laughter, and the more he tried, the more it came. Freddy looked more surprised than hurt. You don't believe me, do you? Milkman couldn't answer. He was laughing so hard. Okay, Freddy said, and threw up his hands. Okay, laugh on, but there's a lot of strange things you don't know nothing about, boy. You'll learn a lot of strange things. Strange stuff going on right in this here town. Milkman's laughter was under control now. What? What strange stuff is happening in this town? I haven't seen any white bulls lately. Open your eyes. Ask your buddy, he knows. What buddy? Your buddy, Guitar. Ask him what strange stuff been happening. Ask him how come he running around with Empire State all of a sudden. Empire State? That's right, Empire State. Nobody runs around with Empire State. He's a nut. He just stands around with a broom, dribbling spit. He can't even talk. He don't talk. That don't mean he can't. Only reason he don't is 'cause he found his wife in bed with another man long time ago, and ain't found nothing to say since then. Well, what's Guitar doing with him? Good question. Police would like to know the answer to that, too. How'd you get from Empire State to the police? You ain't heard? People say the police is looking for a colored man what killed that white boy in the schoolyard. I know that. Everybody knows that. Well, the description fits State. And Guitar been taking him places. Hiding him, I believe. What's so strange about that? You know Guitar's like that. He'll hide anybody the law is looking for. He hates white people, especially cops, and anybody thereafter can count on him for help. You don't understand. Him and State ain't acting like they just hiding him. They acting like he did it. You a little drunk, Freddy? Yeah, I'm a little drunk. But that don't change nothing. Look here. Remember when Emmett Till was killed? Back in 53? Well, right after that, a white boy was killed in a schoolyard, wasn't he? I don't know. I can't remember the dates of murders I haven't committed. You don't know? Freddy was incredulous. No. Are you saying State did it? I'm saying he acts like it. And I'm saying Guitar knows. And I'm saying something strange is going on. That's what I'm saying. He's mad at me, thought Milkman, because I laughed at his mother and that white bull story. So he's trying to get back at me. Keep your eyes open, Freddy went on. Just keep them open. He looked in the pint bottle, saw it was empty, and got up to leave. Yep, some strange things going on round here. But don't put my name in it if you hear anything. Was just like this when that insurance man jumped off the roof. Ever hear tell of him? Seems like I did. That must have been when you was a little bitty baby, 1931. Well, it was some strange stuff then, too. Freddy buttoned his coat and pulled his flap-eared cap down as far as it would go. Well, thanks for the coffee, boy. Did me a lot of good. A lot of good. He took his gloves out of his pocket and moved to the door. You're welcome, Freddy. Merry Christmas, if I don't see you before that. Same to you and your folks. Tell Mr. Dead and your mother I said Merry Christmas. He was smiling again. When he reached the door, he put on his gloves. Then he turned his head slowly and faced Milkman. Tell you somebody else might know about what's going on. Corinthians. Ask Corinthians. He flashed his gold merrily and was gone. Chapter 5. Nothing happened to the fear. He lay in Guitar's bed, face up in the sunlight, trying to imagine how it would feel when the ice pick entered his neck. But picturing a spurt of wine-red blood and wondering if the ice pick would make him cough didn't help. Fear lay like a pair of crossed paws on his chest. He closed his eyes and threw his arm over his face to keep the light from overexposing his thoughts. In the darkness that his arm made, he could see ice picks coming down faster than raindrops had when he tried as a little boy to catch them with his tongue. 5 hours ago, before he knocked on Guitar's door, he had stood on the top step, dripping in the summer rain that still patted the window, imagining that the drops were tiny, steely picks. Then he knocked on the door. Yeah. The voice was lightly aggressive. Guitar never opened his door to a knock anymore before finding out who it was. Me, Milkman, he answered, and waited for the clicking sounds of 3 locks being released. Milkman walked in, hunching his shoulders under his wet suit jacket. Anything to drink? Now you know better than that. Guitar was smiling, his golden eyes dimmed for the moment. They had not seen much of each other since that argument about Honore versus Alabama, but the quarrel had been cleansing for both of them. They were easy with each other now that they didn't have to pretend. When in conversation they came to the battleground of difference, their verbal sparring was full of good humor. Furthermore, their friendship had been tested in more immediate ways. The last 6 months had been dangerous for Milkman, and Guitar had come to his aid over and over again. "Coffee, then," said Milkman. He sat on the bed with the heaviness of a very old man. "How long are you going to keep that up?" "Forever. It's over, man. No booze. How about some tea?"
"Jesus."
"Loose, too. Bet you thought tea grew in little bags. Oh, Christ. Like Louisiana cotton? Except the black man picking it wear diapers and turbans. All over India, that's all you see. Bushes with little bitsy white tea bags blossoming, right? Give me the tea, Guitar. Just the tea, no geography." "No geography? Okay, no geography. What about some history in your tea? Or some socio-political?" "No, that's still geography. Goddamn, Milk, I do believe my whole life's geography. Don't you wash pots out for people before you cook water in them? For example, I live in the north now. So the first question come to mind is, north of what?" "Why, north of the south." "So north exists because south does? But does that mean north is different from south?" "No way. South is just south of north. You don't put the fucking leaves in the boiling water. You pour the water over the leaves in a pot, man, in a teapot." "But there is some slight difference worth noticing. Northerners, for example, born and bred ones, that is, are picky about their food." "Well, not about the food. They actually don't give a shit about the food. What they're picky about is the trappings. You know what I mean? The pots and shit. Now, they're real funny about pots. But tea? They don't know Earl Grey from Old Man Lipton's Instant. I want tea, man. Not wonton shredded wheat. Old Man Lipton, dye him up some shredded New York Times. Put it in a cute little white bag and northern Negroes run amok. Can't contain themselves. Ever notice that? How they love them little white bags. Oh, Jesus. He's a northerner, too. Lived in Israel, but a northerner in his heart. His bleeding heart. His cute little old bleeding red heart. Southerners think they own him, but that's just because the first time they laid eyes on him, he was strung up on a tree. They can relate to that, both the stringer and the strong. But northerners know better. Who you talking about? Black people or white people? Black? White? Don't tell me you one of those racial Negroes. Who said anything about black people? This is just a geography lesson. Guitar handed Milkman a steaming cup of tea. Yeah, well, if this is tea, I'm a soft fried egg. See what I mean? Picky. Why you got to be a soft fried egg? Why can't you be just a fried egg? Or just a plain old egg? And why an egg anyway? Negro's been a lot of things, but he ain't never been no egg. Milkman began to laugh. Guitar had done it again. He'd come to the door sopping wet, ready to roll over and die, and now he was laughing, spilling tea, and choking out his reply. How come? How come a nigger can't be a egg? He can be a egg if he wants to. Nope, can't be no egg. It ain't in him. Something about his genes. His genes won't let him be no egg, no matter how hard he tries. Nature says no. No, you can't be no egg, nigger. Now you can be a crow if you want to, or a big baboon, but not no egg. Eggs is difficult, complicated, fragile too, and white. They got brown eggs, miscegenation. Besides, don't nobody want them. French people do. In France, yeah, but not in the Congo. Frenchman in the Congo won't touch a brown egg. Why won't he? Scared of him? Might do something to his skin, like the sun. French people love the sun. They're always trying to get in the sun. On the Riviera, they try to get in the French sun, but not the Congo sun. In the Congo, they hate the sun. Well, I got a right to be what I want to be, and I want to be an egg. Fried, fried. Then somebody got to bust your shell. Quicker than a pulse beat, guitar had changed the air. Milkman wiped his mouth, avoiding guitar's eyes, because he knew the phosphorus was back in them. The little room stood at attention in the quiet. It was a second-story porch, walled in to make a room for rent, so the landlady could get an income from it and have a watchman, too. Its outside stairway made it perfect for a bachelor, especially a secretive one like Guitar Baines. "Can I have the pad tonight?" Milkman asked him. He examined his fingernails. "To cop?" Milkman shook his head. Guitar didn't believe him, didn't believe his friend really wanted to be alone the night before the day of his own murder. "That's scary, man, very scary." Milkman didn't answer. "You're not obliged to go through no number, you know, not for me. Everybody knows you're brave when you want to be." Milkman looked up, but still did not answer. "Still and all," Guitar went on carefully, "you might get your heart cut out. Then you'll be just another brave nigger what got wasted." Milkman reached for the pell-mell package. It was empty, so he pulled a longish butt from the planter's peanut butter jar top that was Guitar's ashtray for the day. He stretched out on the bed, letting his long fingers rub the pocket places in his clothes where matches might be. "Everything's cool," he said. "Shit," said Guitar, "ain't nothing cool. Nothing, nowhere. Even the North Pole ain't cool." "You think so? Go on up there and watch them fucking glaciers ice your ass. And what the glaciers don't get, the polar bears will." Guitar stood up, his head almost touching the ceiling. Annoyed by Milkman's indifference, he relieved his agitation by straightening up the room. He pulled an empty crate from underneath the straight-backed chair leaning in the corner, and started dumping trash into the box. Dead matches from the windowsill, pork bones from the barbecue he had eaten the day before. He crumpled the pleated paper cups that had been overflowing with coleslaw and fired them into the crate. "Every nigger I know wants to be cool. There's nothing wrong with controlling yourself. But can't nobody control other people?" He looked sideways at Milkman's face, alert for any sign, any opening. This kind of silence was new. Something must have happened. Guitar was genuinely worried about his friend. But he also didn't want anything to happen in his room that would bring the police there. He picked up the peanut butter top ashtray. "Wait, there's still some good butts in there." Milkman spoke softly. Guitar dumped the whole ashtray into the box. "What'd you do that for? You know we don't have no cigarettes." "Then move your ass and go get some." "Come on, Guitar, cut the shit." Milkman rose from the bed and reached for the crate. He would have gotten it, except Guitar stepped back and flung it all the way across the room, letting the mess settle right back where it came from. Graceful and economical as a cat, he arced his arm out of the swing and slammed his fist up against the wall, forming a barrier to any move Milkman might make. "Pay attention." Guitar's voice was low. "Pay attention when I'm trying to tell you something. Head to head, toe to toe, they stood. Milkman's left foot hovered above the floor, and Guitar's eyes, with their phosphorus lights, singed his heart a little. But he took the stare. And if I don't, what then, man? You gonna do me in? My name is Macon, remember? I'm already dead. Guitar didn't smile at the familiar joke, but there was enough recognition of it in his face to soften the glare in his eyes. Somebody ought to tell your murderer that, said Guitar. Milkman gave a short laugh and moved back toward the bed. You worry too much, Guitar. I worry just enough. But right now, I need to know how come you ain't worried at all. You come up here knowing it's the 30th day, knowing if anybody wants to find you, they come here, if not first, then last. And you ask me to leave you by yourself. Just tell me what you're doing. Look, Milkman said, out of all those times, I was scared just twice, the first time and the third. I've been handling it ever since, right? Yeah, but something's funny this time. Ain't nothing funny. Yeah, it is. You funny. No, I'm not. Just tired. Tired of dodging crazy people. Tired of this dive town, of running up and down these streets, getting nowhere. Well, you're home free if tired is all you are. Soon you'll have all the rest you ever need. Can't promise you the bed's comfortable. But morticians don't make mattresses. Maybe she won't come this time. She ain't missed in 6 months. You counting on her taking a holiday or something? I can't hide from that bitch no more. I gotta stop it. I don't want to go through this again a month from now. Why don't you get her people to do something? I am her people. Listen, Milk. I'll split if you say so. But just listen to me a minute. That broad had a Carlson Skinner knife last time. You know how sharp a Carlson Skinner knife is? Cut you like a laser, man. I know. No, you don't know. You was up under the bar when me and Moon grabbed her. I know what she had. Won't be no Moon in this room tomorrow, and no Guitar either if I listen to you. This time she might have a pistol. What fool is gonna give a colored woman a pistol? Same fool that gave Porter a shotgun. That was years ago. It ain't even that that bothers me. It's the way you actin', like you want it, like you're looking forward to it. Where'd you think that up? Look at you. You all dressed up. I had to work in Sonny's shop. You know my old man makes me dress up like this when I'm behind the desk. You had time to change. It's past midnight. Okay, so I'm clean. So I'm looking forward to it. I just got through telling you I don't want to hide no more. It's a secret, ain't it? You got yourself a secret. That makes two of us. Two? You and her? No, you and me. You've been making some funny smoke screens lately. Milkman looked up at Guitar and smiled. Just so you don't think I ain't noticed. Guitar grinned back. Now that he knew there was a secret, he settled down into the groove of their relationship. Okay, Mr. Dead Sir, you on your own. Would you ask your visitor to kind of neaten things up a little before she goes? I don't want to come back and have to look through a pile of cigarette butts for your head. Be nice if it was laying somewhere I could spot it right off. And if it's her head that's left behind, well, there's some towels in the closet on the shelf in the back. Rest your mind, boy. Ain't nobody giving up no head. They laughed then at the suitableness of the unintended pun. And it was in the sound of this laughter that Guitar picked up his brown leather jacket, and started out the door. "Cigarettes," Milkman called after him. "Bring me some cigarettes before you disappear." "Gotcha." Guitar was halfway down the stairs. Already his thoughts had left Milkman and had flown ahead to the house where six old men waited for him. He didn't come back that night. Milkman lay quietly in the sunlight, his mind a blank, his lungs craving smoke. Gradually, his fear of and eagerness for death returned. Above all, he wanted to escape what he knew, escape the implications of what he had been told. And all he knew in the world, about the world, was what other people had told him. He felt like a garbage pail for the actions and hatreds of other people. He himself did nothing, except for the one time he had hit his father. He had never acted independently, and that act, his only one, had brought unwanted knowledge too, as well as some responsibility for that knowledge. When his father told him about Ruth, he joined him in despising her. But he felt put upon, felt as though some burden had been given to him and that he didn't deserve it. None of that was his fault, and he didn't want to have to think or be or do something about any of it. In that mood of lazy righteousness, he wallowed in Guitar's bed. That same righteousness that had made him tail his mother like a secret agent when she left the house a week or so ago. Returning home from a party, he had hardly pulled Macon's Buick up to the curb and turned off the car lights when he saw his mother walking a little ahead of him down Not Doctor Street. It was 1:30 in the morning, but in spite of the hour and her turned-up coat collar, there was no air of furtiveness about her at all. She was walking in what seemed to him a determined manner, neither hurried nor aimless. Just the even-paced walk of a woman on her way to some modest but respectable work. When Ruth turned the corner, Milkman waited a minute and started up the car, creeping, not letting the engine slide into high gear. He drove around the corner. She was standing at the bus stop, so Milkman waited in the shadows until the bus came and she boarded it. Surely this was no meeting of lovers. The man would have picked her up nearby somewhere. No man would allow a woman he had any affection for to come to him on public transportation in the middle of the night, especially a woman as old as Ruth. And what man wanted a woman over 60 anyway? Following the bus was a nightmare. It stopped too often, too long, and it was difficult to tail it, hide, and watch to see if she got off. Milkman turned on the car radio, but the music, which he hoped would coat his nerve ends, only splayed them. He was very nervous and thought seriously about turning back. Finally, the bus pulled up at the Intracounty train station, its last stop. There, among the few remaining passengers, he saw her go into the lobby of the station. He believed he'd lost her. He'd never find out what train she was taking. He thought again of going back home. It was late, he was exhausted, and he wasn't sure he wanted to know any more about his mother. But having come this far, he realized it was foolish to turn back now and leave things forever up in the air. He parked in the lot and walked slowly toward the station. Maybe she's not taking a train, he thought. Maybe he meets her in the station. He looked around carefully before pushing open the doors. There was no sign of her inside. It was a small, plain building, old but well lit. Looming over the modest waiting room was the Great Seal of Michigan in vivid technicolor, painted, probably, by some high school art class. Two pink deer reared up on their hind legs, facing each other, and an eagle perched at eye level between them. The eagle's wings were open and looked like raised shoulders. Its head was turned to the left. One fierce eye bored into that of a deer. Purple Latin words stretched in a long ribbon beneath the seal. Sequeris peninsulam emoenam circumspice. Milkman didn't understand the Latin, and he didn't understand why the Wolverine State had a buck painted on the seal. Or were they does? He remembered Guitar's story about killing one. A man shouldn't do that. Milkman felt a quick beat of something like remorse, but he shook it off and resumed his search for his mother. He walked to the back of the station, still no sight of her. Then he noticed that there was an upper platform, stairs leading to it, and an arrow with the words Fairfield and Northeastern Suburbs painted on it. Perhaps she was up there. He moved cautiously toward the stairs, glancing up and all around, lest he see her or miss her. A loudspeaker broke the silence, announcing the arrival of the 2:15 train to Fairfield Heights, leaving from the upper platform. He dashed up the stairs then, just in time to see Ruth step into a car and to jump into another car himself. The train made 10 stops at about 10-minute intervals. He leaned out between the cars at each stop to see if she was getting off. After the 6th stop, he asked the conductor when the next train returned to the city. 5:45 a.m., he said. Milkman looked at his watch. It was already 3 o'clock. When the conductor called out Fairfield Heights, last stop, a half hour later, Milkman looked out again, and this time he saw her disembark. He darted behind the three-sided wooden structure that sheltered waiting passengers from the wind until he heard her wide rubber heels padding down the steps. Beyond the shelter, along the street below, were stores, all closed now, newsstands, coffee shops, stationery shops, but no houses. The wealthy people of Fairfield did not live near a train station, and very few of their houses could even be seen from the road. Nevertheless, Ruth walked in her even-paced way down the street, and in just a few minutes was at the wide, winding lane that led into Fairfield Cemetery. As Milkman stared at the ironwork arched over the entrance, he remembered snatches of his mother's chatter about having looked so very carefully for a cemetery for the doctor's body, some place other than the one where Negroes were all laid together in one area. And 40 years ago, Fairfield was farm country, with a county cemetery too tiny for anybody to care whether its dead were white or black. Milkman leaned against a tree and waited at the entrance. Now he knew, if he had any doubts, that all his father had told him was true. She was a silly, selfish, queer, faintly obscene woman. Again, he felt abused. Why couldn't anybody in his whole family just be normal? He waited for an hour before she came out. "Hello, Mama," he said. He tried to make his voice sound as coolly cruel as he felt, just as he tried to frighten her by stepping out suddenly from behind the tree. He succeeded. She stumbled in alarm and took a great gulp of air into her mouth. "Macon? Is that you? You're here? Oh, my goodness, I..." She tried desperately to normalize the situation, smiling wanly and blinking her eyes, searching for words and manners and civilization. Milkman stopped her. "You come to lay down on your father's grave? Is that what you've been doing all these years? Spending a night every now and then with your father?" Ruth's shoulders seemed to slump. But she said, in a surprisingly steady voice, "Let's walk toward the train stop." Neither said a word during the 45 minutes they waited in the little shelter for the train back to the city. The sun came up and pointed out the names of young lovers painted on the wall. A few men were walking up the stairs to the platform. When the train backed in from its siding, they still had not spoken. Only when the wheels were actually turning and the engine had cleared its throat did Ruth begin. And she began in the middle of a sentence, as though she had been thinking it all through since she and her son left the entrance to Fairfield Cemetery. "Because the fact is that I'm a small woman. I don't mean little, I mean small. And I'm small because I was pressed small. I live in a great big house that pressed me into a small package. I had no friends, only schoolmates who wanted to touch my dresses and my white silk stockings. But I didn't think I'd ever need a friend because I had him. I was small, but he was big. The only person who ever really cared whether I lived or died. Lots of people were interested in whether I lived or died, but he cared. He was not a good man, Macon. Certainly he was an arrogant man, and often a foolish and destructive one. But he cared whether, and he cared how, I lived. And there was, and is, no one else in the world who ever did, and for that I would do anything. It was important for me to be in his presence, among his things, the things he used, had touched. Later it was just important for me to know that he was in the world. When he left it, I kept on reigniting that cared for feeling that I got from him. I am not a strange woman. I am a small one. I don't know what all your father has told you about me down in that shop you all stay in. But I know, as well as I know my own name, that he told you only what was flattering to him. I know he never told you that he killed my father, and that he tried to kill you, because both of you took my attention away from him. I know he never told you that. And I know he never told you that he threw my father's medicine away. But it's true. And I couldn't save my father. Macon took away his medicine. And I just didn't know it. And I wouldn't have been able to save you except for Pilate. Pilate was the one brought you here in the first place. Pilate? Milkman was coming awake. He had begun listening to his mother with the dulled ear of someone who was about to be conned and knew it. Pilate. Old, crazy, sweet Pilate. Your father and I hadn't had physical relations since my father died, when Lena and Corinthians were just toddlers. We had a terrible quarrel. He threatened to kill me. I threatened to go to the police about what he had done to my father. We did neither. I guess my father's money was more important to him than the satisfaction of killing me. And I would have happily died except for my babies. But he did move into another room. And that's the way things stayed until I couldn't stand it anymore. Until I thought I'd really die if I had to live that way, with nobody touching me or even looking as though they'd like to touch me. That's when I started coming to Fairfield to talk. To talk to somebody who wanted to listen and not laugh at me. Somebody I could trust. Somebody who trusted me. Somebody who was interested in me. For my own self. I didn't care if that somebody was under the ground. You know, I was 20 years old when your father stopped sleeping in the bed with me. That's hard, Macon. Very hard. By the time I was 30, I think I was just afraid I'd die that way. Then Pilot came to town. She came into this city like she owned it. Pilot, Reba, and Reba's little baby, Hager. Pilot came to see Macon right away, and as soon as she saw me, she knew what my trouble was. And she asked me one day, "Do you want him?" "I want somebody," I told her. "He's as good as anybody," she said. "Besides, you'll get pregnant, and your baby ought to be his. He ought to have a son. Otherwise, this be the end of us." She gave me funny things to do, and some greenish-gray, grassy-looking stuff to put in his food. Ruth laughed. I felt like a doctor, like a chemist, doing some big, important scientific experiment. It worked, too. Macon came to me for 4 days. He even came home from his office in the middle of the day to be with me. He looked puzzled, but he came. Then it was over, and 2 months later, I was pregnant. When he found out about it, he immediately suspected Pilot, and he told me to get rid of the baby. But I wouldn't, and Pilot helped me stand him off. I wouldn't have been strong enough without her. She saved my life, and yours, Macon. She saved yours, too. She watched you, like you were her own, until your father threw her out. Milkman leaned his head against the cold handbar that was attached to the seat in front of him. He held it there, letting its chill circle his head. Then he turned to his mother. "Were you in the bed with your father when he was dead, naked?" "No, but I did kneel there in my slip at his bedside and kiss his beautiful fingers. They were the only part of him that wasn't..." "You nursed me." "Yes, until I was old, too old." Ruth turned toward her son. She lifted her head and looked deep into his eyes. "And I also prayed for you every single night and every single day. On my knees. Now you tell me, what harm did I do you on my knees?" That was the beginning. Now it was all going to end. In a little while, she would walk in the door, and this time he would let her do it. Afterward, there would be no remembrance of who he was or where. Of Magdalene called Lena and First Corinthians, of his father trying to stop him dead before he was born, of the brilliant bitterness between his father and his mother, a bitterness as smooth and fixed as steel. And he wouldn't have those waking dreams or hear those awful words his mother had spoken to him. What harm? What harm did I do you on my knees? He could hear her footsteps, and then the sound of the doorknob turning, sticking, and turning again. He knew without uncovering his eyes that she was right there, looking at him through the window. Hagar. Killing. Ice-pick-wielding Hagar, who, shortly after a Christmas thank-you note, found herself each month searching the barrels and cupboards and basement shelves for some comfortably portable weapon with which to murder her true love. The thank you cut her to the quick, but it was not the reason she ran scurrying into cupboards looking for weapons. That had been accomplished by the sight of Milkman's arms around the shoulder of a girl whose silky, copper-colored hair cascaded over the sleeve of his coat. They were sitting in Mary's, smiling into glasses of Jack Daniels on the rocks. The girl looked a little like Corinthians or Lena from the back, and when she turned, laughing toward Milkman, and Hagar saw her gray eyes, the fist that had been just sitting in her chest since Christmas, released its forefinger like the blade of a skinning knife. As regularly as the new moon searched for the tide, Hagar looked for a weapon and then slipped out of her house and went to find the man for whom she believed she had been born into the world. Being 5 years older than he was, and his cousin as well, did nothing to dim her passion. In fact, her maturity and blood kinship converted her passion to fever, so it was more affliction than affection. It literally knocked her down at night and raised her up in the morning, for when she dragged herself off to bed, having spent another day without his presence, her heart beat like a gloved fist against her ribs. And in the morning, long before she was fully awake, she felt a longing so bitter and tight it yanked her out of a sleep swept clean of dreams. She moved around the house, onto the porch, down the streets, to the fruit stalls and the butcher shop, like a restless ghost, finding peace nowhere and in nothing. Not in the first tomato off the vine, split open and salted lightly, which her grandmother put before her. Not the 6-piece set of pink glass dishes Reba won at the Tivoli Theater, and not the carved wax candle that the two of them made for her. Pilot dipping the wick and Reba scratching out tiny flowers with a nail file and put in a genuine store-bought candle holder next to her bed. Not even the high, fierce sun at noon, nor the ocean-dark evenings. Nothing could pull her mind away from the mouth Milkman was not kissing, the feet that were not running toward him, the eye that no longer beheld him, the hands that were not touching him. She toyed sometimes with her unsucked breasts, but at some point her lethargy dissipated of its own accord, and in its place was wilderness, the focused meanness of a flood or an avalanche of snow, which only observers flying in a rescue helicopter believed to be an indifferent natural phenomenon, but which the victims, in their last gulp of breath, knew was both directed and personal. The calculated violence of a shark